welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. I'm Chris Lucian. Joining with me is my co-host, Austin Chadwick. And today we have Mark Holmes to talk about micro-retrospectives, experimentation, and communication, or TDD for people. So I think, Mark, why don't you introduce yourself and then we can get into some of those topics.
Okay, great. Yeah, Mark, I have a background in software engineering. Over the years, I worked a lot with teams and worked my way up to an architect of sorts, working with teams to kind of improve their systems end to end for the organization, higher level work, but I still deliver some software here and there with the teams because it keeps me grounded and out of the clouds. And just over time, I think I've had a rapid growth in my interest in all the people side of things, you know, people problems, a strength of restorative. It's almost the first right avenue for problems emerging. And then we get into technical problems. So yeah, just fascinated with improving how people do people with themselves, with each other, and how that can really benefit the work of technology.
Yeah, and that seems to really relate to our show, not at all, because I mean, with Mobbed, you don't have to deal with people. You can just, you know, it's just you and the code and you're alone. And yeah, so I wanted to say, I really love this concept of TDD for people. I mean, me personally have experienced a lot of benefit with TDD technically. So let's jump on in. What do you mean by TDD for people?
Yeah, sure. I'm borrowing that concept. I read a book, Agile Conversations, and it introduced me to the work of Chris Argyris, the organizational psychologist. He was a predecessor of Peter Senge, and he introduced a concept or a tool we can look at later as the ladder of inference. But so the authors here, either Douglas or Jeffrey, kind of, that's how I heard of the concept of TDD for people. And just thinking about the concept of our software work and test-driven development and the effort we put in to say, this is what we want to accomplish, implement it simply, and then refactor it, and then do that again. That's kind of like the lifeblood of programming, certainly of mobbing. And well, we're people, and just like as I've come to learn from y'all, how driving has navigating first, code is conceptually spoken at a higher level to communicate value through someone else's hands and going into the computer. Well, what if we did that when we communicated? Because like you said, I might be talking to the wrong crowd here. You guys are the exception as mobbers, the community, but how many of us spend how much time talking to people versus talking to a computer by ourselves? Why don't we just apply this to our conversations? So I've actually had a chance to attend a few what are called conversational dojos with the author and just practiced. Like, how do we build, let's say, for example, a test case for communicating? The ladder of inference starts with data, and then it moves on to meaning and conclusions and et cetera, and moves up to a higher level of thinking. But starting with data, it's like, even if somebody made a statement and you said, hey, I heard you say this, is that right? Right? That's like your first test. And if they say, no, that's not what I said, or no, that's not what I meant, now you've got a red, right? Okay, now what are we gonna do? What's the simplest thing I can do to make sure that this is passing? Oh, could you repeat yourself? Or what did you mean, right? A question that introduces curiosity and checking instead of pushing on to what we might call other dependencies that would fail downstream anyway. We know that, right? We can't ship bad units. So let's fix the unit first. That's the idea anyway.
Wow, I love that. And what's funny is I think Chris and I have had this conversation a couple times. I think it was you, Chris, who were teaching me that communication is experimentation. And instead of like sending a big batch, like a big, huge email or a big, long chat message, right, to somebody, you know, how can you run the smallest possible experiment to see where that person is at, right? Mm-hmm. And so me being more of a verbose person, I might send a chat message that's got 30 things in it, where if you misunderstand the first sentence, the next 29 aren't going to help you, right? So, and so
It's kind of a big problem with email, because email incentivizes big batches. And so it's kind of a little bit of a tangent, but it's kind of like why things like Slack and Microsoft Teams work so well, is because the incentive structure is different. Emails, you need to kind of include every single little thing before you get a reply, and they're very formal, and you know, it's almost like, you know, writing out a handwritten letter and putting their address on an envelope and putting a stamp on it and sending it, right? Compared to what chat is, which is kind of this back and forth. And so, you know, I find that, a lot of times you have to evaluate somebody else's understanding. So I really like the concept, and I don't think I've ever had really a name for it until I heard about this year. So this is really cool.
Yeah. And another thing that jumps out to me about it is it just makes me think about when you're having a conversation, you want a tight feedback loop. I mean, you don't want to be robotic about it, I guess, because then you'd probably be annoying. You don't want to literally sound like you're a unit test. Like, I said the word the. Have you understood the word the? Okay, I'm going to say the next word, you know. But like, if I'm monologuing in a meeting or a mob for a long time, the likelihood of people understanding me is or misunderstanding me is growing the longer I talk without a check, right?
Yeah, computers tend to not be bothered by being patronized, whereas humans do.
So Mark, how are you using this? Do you have any kind of practical examples of where this concept has helped and has it removed misunderstandings for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think just with families, you know, that's what I kind of consider the smallest or the primary organization that I'm a part of.
Yeah.
In terms of just human existence. And yeah, it's easy to misunderstand people. And, you know, you add more people. There's my direct family, my immediate family, I guess. And then there's in-laws and friends of friends. And when you mix in those kind of other one or more removed distance, if you will, relationally, there's less practice, there's less, you know, familiarity, right? I mean, even the concept of a family, familiarity diminishes. And so I don't know their styles, I don't know their idioms, I don't know their, you know, catchphrases and things. And I'm a pretty semantic person. And the more complicated the discussion or the topic, especially if we bring emotion into it and things, which I tend to have a lot of, this just kind of helps bring us down to a common place, which is data and language. And, you know, just asking more questions has just proven time and time again to be a more effective strategy. Even though it might come across, I've noticed some people say they don't like questions so much, you know, and even right then it's like, oh, tell me what bothers you about questions, right? Right there is a question to understand them better, right? Before I make an assumption. They don't like questions because they think, you know, I distrust them, or they might be making an assumption that I'm asking questions because I don't trust them. And if we enter curiosity, then I can say, well, I ask questions to understand. I like to engage, even if I'm not debating, you know, I'm not criticizing when I ask a question. I found that a very common one that people feel, especially in the workplace. If I ask a lot of questions as an architect, I'm just hoping to understand, and I've already trusted my team. I just want to get on board. And if I have any questions, ask them. A lot of times it's like, well, we can do something different. And I said, oh, what makes you say that? Again, the question, so that I don't assume, right? Because I often respond by saying, well, and I'm thinking now there's this like authority dynamic, and I have to talk to the person and say, how do I make you feel? And then it might get awkward. I have no problem talking about feelings with anyone who'd like to, but yeah, just it removes assumptions just to ask another question. Oh, what makes you say that? So it's, I found that very helpful.
It's kind of an interesting side effect of asking a lot of questions. I think I find that when you kind of get into that mode of asking, you know, more questions than people are used to, it's almost like it's being misinterpreted as the Socratic method and maybe a negative interpretation of the Socratic method, maybe. And so people backtracking on decisions based on questions that you ask, clarifying questions that you ask, I think that's almost a side effect of the, you know, is this person asking questions because they know I'm wrong. And so do you have any advice for anybody that might be trying to get past that that perception?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
You should ask a question back to Chris.
I know, but then I'd be doing what we don't like about it, right? I'd be like irritating him. My mind is cast back to, I think, a decision-making framework, but I'm not going to think of it right now. I might send it out as a follow-up, but providing context up front. It's about how to give people feedback. And so the idea is, if I can give them feedback early, I might be able to avoid any kind of unintended consequence. So for example, hey, I've been listening to what you've described. I have a few questions just because I'm curious, right? I think I like everything that I'm hearing. I'm just unclear on something. So could I ask you a couple of questions, right?
Yeah.
And then at the end, I'm asking permission. Instead of just questioning them, if we remove my worry about my intent, their worry about my intent, and I just say, hey, can I ask some clarifying questions? That might put us off on more of a gentler context and avoid the need for the assumption to fill in that gap.
Yeah, and I really like that a lot. A couple of things come to mind from what you just said that I thought was awesome, which is, I think people do sense an imbalance, like if it can start to feel like an interrogation. And so one thing I heard was to share, you know, because I've been there before where someone's asking questions and you start to wonder, well, where are they at? What do you, you know? And I think if you can ask those questions back, but some people will just sit there and wonder like, oh, are they just interrogating me and they think I'm wrong? So I think like what you did, you put some context like, hey, here's my intent. Here's the situation. Here's some questions. And then after they answer a couple, I might be like, you know, affirm common ground. Oh, I really like what you said about this. Can you tell me more about it or something like that? And a more extreme example I've heard, but it actually seems to work pretty well. And it's kind of an old TV reference. Have you guys heard of the show, TV show Columbo?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like I've heard it called the Columbo tactic, where he's like a detective who appears to be, you know, not super smart, but he's just like, oh, help me understand. And he just seems curious, and like people kind of put him off as just like, but he just asks a lot of questions, but the way he asks them, it doesn't feel like an interrogation. It almost feels like, oh, you're helping out this guy who doesn't know what's going on, you know?
Nice.
And you don't have to go that extreme, but the idea is, you know, you can ask questions very authoritatively, right? As it, you know, especially if you're in a role like an architect, it could sound very authoritative or something like that. But yeah, that really helps a lot. Yeah, great. And so what are some other TDD for people type things that you had in mind?
Sure. So the basic idea is checking data. We could consider the next rung on the ladder. I referred to the ladder of inference from Chris Argyris, but he moves up to, you know, selected data. So this concept of bias that we read a lot about these days, and when you study psychology and neuroscience, it's like we have to admit these days that we can't escape bias. It's just a part of us, but if we understand it, then we can kind of work with it. And bias has a lot of really good benefits for us as social creatures, and needing safety and, you know, physical needs and psychological needs. So it has its purpose. I don't want to think, I heard someone say they prefer preference, that a bias is a preference based on some reason. And if we just know if it's a negative preference or a positive preference, then we can work on that, right? Whereas bias even has a negative connotation. Oh, you're so biased. You know? Well, we all are. Now, are we all good? Okay, great. So let's move on. So why do I select the data that I select, right? I said something, let's say I say a sentence and someone picks out one word. If you're listening, that can be an indicator. If they pick out a word that wasn't the topic and then their response is based on that word, and I feel like, oh, you know, I have that curiosity. Instead of saying, oh, you missed my point, which sounds harsh and accusatory, I could just say, hey, I noticed you were talking about that word. And back to our questions, bring them back down to data, right? What makes you, you know, respond to that particular word? That will give them an avenue to let you know a little bit more about their context. And that's another powerful dimension that I've learned in these practice sessions, is we have to admit that when I talk with someone, it's not just me. That's the ego. It's natural, right? It's us communicating. So I have a context and my context will be very different than your context, right? I will have needs and they'll be very different than your needs. And it and this technique goes so far as to say, I have my own experience, my own, I forget how it was said exactly, but we're both going to have ladders that we walk and they're not going to be the same ladder. They're just going to have the same steps. So I hope that helps, but if we get beyond data and we don't have enough data, all we have to do is ask a question to bring us back to it. Instead of hey, you seem to care about this, or you care about this is worse. Because now, again, I'm making a declarative statement rather than, hey, I noticed observation of data. And in this case, we're recorded, so we can all go back and look at the data that happened, right? That's kind of powerful. We don't always have that when we're talking to folks in real time. But yeah. That makes sense.
No, it does. It does. And I think it's something I've been saying lately, and I don't know what you would think about this statement, Chris or Mark, but I feel like mobbing, and I think what I'm starting to learn from this conversation is that conversations with people in general are a investment in people first, and then the topic or even the product at hand second. And that might sound terrible to a product manager who's like, what, you know, you don't care about the product, right? But the thing is, if investing in the people is investing in the product, because the product doesn't maintain itself, right? And so like when you made the point about, hey, you're not understanding my point, and you go back to making your point, is that if you don't have the person, if the person's not bought into the conversation, there's no way you can make your point and it have an effect, right? So I think to be agile in the conversation and prioritize what's most important is like, oh, this person has a concern about something kind of related to what we're talking about, and we need to address that. That really stood out to me. I don't know. What do you think? What do you think about people are first a priority statement there, Chris or Mark?
Well, you know, I think that obviously the people that you work with, you have these relationships, and these relationships are really important to maintain. You're obviously working together with a common goal, and you also want to understand each other quickly. And so, you know, because I have a tendency to always go back to lean, right? What's the most lean thing for the product to have? Is it focus on the product or focus on the people? You know, it's arguable that to be lean, you need to reduce errors in understanding or misunderstandings, right? Reducing misunderstandings will lead to a more lean flow. And so just like failures in the pipeline, communication failures are actually going to be more expensive than a pipeline failure, right? And so, you know, a misunderstanding in communication or people or a, you know, so say you had a low investment on people in general, then that would increase the rate of communication failures. Communication failures can be the most expensive failure because, you know, in one situation, if the software fails, that might be not a communication failure, but just a failure of the software. But if you have a communication failure, you might actually write the wrong software. And so I think that people in all cases are likely a dependency for, you know, the interactions of the people are a dependency on all lean flow downstream. Right? That's maybe how I'd look at it.
Yeah. I'd like to call out a couple of things that I heard each of you say, and I think it's right. Absolutely, people come first. I've heard the quote, grow people and then build product. And then when we think about, go back to Lean and Toyota, I've seen pictures where they post on their wall, you know, good thinking, good products. And the thinking come from people. And then the two pillars of Lean, which can be misunderstood. You ask people about Lean and commonly they can talk about waste reduction and safety and things. But the two pillars of Lean are respect for people first, then continuous improvement toward perfection. So we've got to start with respecting people, and then we can move on to building good products. So I think you're right on. And I would even say I think if I heard Austin correct, I would expect product owners to actually not think poorly about that perspective. I would want them to value their team and respect people within the organization as a way to build excellent products. And then what I heard Chris say, when I think about units going into integration, going into, you know, functional and acceptance, going into production software, we know it's cheaper to fix a problem before it's released, right? We want to reduce the number of escaped bugs. But when we look at queuing theory and complexity, each dependency you add doesn't just have a one linear impact. It actually accelerates the cost downstream and you know, doubles your chance of being late in a queue. So it's not a simple impact. It's actually a very compounded impact. So I love that you're kind of describing that idea.
Yeah. And I have a follow-up question, but I have it scheduled to tweet. So that's kind of funny. A quote from Moretz Mob Ensemble programming book. And it said, you know, cost of rework. We can track cost of delays of knowledge, cost of delays, but cost of knowledge gaps or misunderstandings were accounted for, there'd be less resistance to mobbing and ensemble programming, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a hard thing to track, right? But if you could track it, there'd be a lot less resistance. And I found that pretty novel. So maybe to take a practical turn here. So let's say you're inspired by increasing, you know, the frequency of your feedback loops and communication and reducing, you know, misunderstanding. What would you recommend as far as maybe growth? And then is maybe one stream of questions. And then the other one is like, are there like a practical list of questions that are helpful if you don't know where to go in a conversation to help it improve? So I guess you can take that any way you like.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. A couple of things come to mind. One is to follow up on some of these tools like the ladder of inference, and it just gives you a framework to fall back onto. So, hey, I want to get to data, you know, just kind of, okay. The logical next step is what data questions might I ask in conversations? Mm. And I would encourage folks who want to get started, maybe to just start taking notes, mental notes, written notes in a conversation, because the dojo is focused on conversational analysis. How do we practice taking conversations, particularly ones that didn't go well or were more difficult than we expected or that we liked? And simply write data in the right column. I said, I heard, or they said, I said, they said. And then go back on the left column and introduce the feelings and the thoughts, the things that are invisible. And that's a huge key for conversational analysis, is to make visible or data what is invisible and not data. Because the more we can get that out of the bias, out of the fast pattern of our cognition, jumping to conclusions, you know, forming opinions and beliefs, and then acting. So I read the book, That's Not What I Meant, by Deborah, I'm going to botch the name, but it's a psychologist that I'll look it up and we can add it in the show notes. But that's not what I meant. Have you ever had the conversation where you're like, hey, do you want to go to you know, so-and-so's party this afternoon? Oh, why? Oh, we don't have to go, you know? Oh, okay, well, we didn't even, you know, maybe there was an assumption there. Why did the person ask why you want to go? Maybe they were curious. Maybe they were tired. Maybe, you know, there's all these unknowns. And then you just go, okay, we don't have to do that. Did we have a conversation? And I just laugh every time I think of that example, because I've had those conversations. And that's the jumping the ladder of inference. It's going from data. Hey, how about we go to, oh, why? Both data. But then I jump to a conclusion and it's like, oh, they probably don't want to go. So, oh, we don't have to go, you know, and maybe I'm being nice, but I might've missed an opportunity for two outcomes. One, to better understand where that person is at, a friend or my wife or whomever, right? Significant other, children, you know, it doesn't matter. Any human, know more about where they're coming from, their context, right? And then the other outcome is maybe if the answer is no, instead of yes, with that new context, I can better serve that person. Oh, well, maybe we'll have a movie night in today because I found out that they're tired and they would love to go, but not today, right? I love the potential for whatever direction the decision goes. If we know more about our contexts, there's going to be a better outcome most likely. Mm. So yeah, start taking notes. I guess that's the point. And just kind of maybe, you know, get started with this conversational analysis, even asking ourselves more questions, more data questions, can be a good first step.
Nice. And I think one jumps to mind that I think I heard you say earlier, which is you paraphrase what you thought you heard.
Mm. Mirroring, back to the, I think it's called.
Yeah, something. Mirroring, right? And I think while I've seen it happen somewhat recently too, where, you know, a product manager, product owner says, hey, I want X. And the team just said, okay. And they went and did what they thought X was and then found out later that X was not what he said, right? And so mm-hmm. I think for me, the way I've tried to instill that is to never leave any discussion just on the surface, right? So to be like, okay, by X, I'm hearing you mean this, or mm-hmm. ask a question like, what did you mean? What do you mean by X? Even if I think I understand, I know what you mean, but
sure.
Yeah, just always asking at least one follow-up question to have, because you're right, that is, before we go write a unit test for the functionality we thought he just said, let's do the conversation unit test to make sure we understand each other.
Yeah.
I mean, are there any other questions you rely on when you're not sure what to do in a conversation, or any, because I'm trying to think of some personality types where some people are really good on the fly improvising, others aren't. And, you know, is there any advice for someone like that who's in the middle of a conversation, they know it's not going well? Is there some moves that is maybe not catch all, but something that you don't have to be a great improv at to, yeah. I don't know, maybe I'm stretching here, but any thoughts there?
Oh, that sounds great. I would say indicators. Right?
Yeah.
For me, I'm pretty emotional and I can feel when I'm uncomfortable in a conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's the first moment to ask myself why. Mm-hmm. If I can just, even something as simple as, when you hear something you don't like, will give you just enough space. I think Michael Bungay Stanius said, you know, giving yourself space to show up better by distancing stimulation and response.
Hmm.
Because somebody says something, I took it wrong. I want to reflect and then act instead of react.
Hmm.
So even something like, or even reflecting back gives you that time and space to distance yourself from something that felt. And the feelings you can't change. I mean, neuroscience tells us they happen. Every thought goes through the emotional center of our brain before it gets into language. So why would we try to change the feelings? That's one word of caution is don't try to feel less defensive, right? Whatever that means, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Just work on distancing your response, reflecting, asking another question, or just saying, before you respond. The other thing that came to mind was nonviolent communication. Many may have heard of. It talks about four components: observations, that's the data part, real needs, real feelings, and requests. And the real bit is another check on, like, the ladder has steps that we want to possess, just like we want a failed test, a passing test, before we move on, right? And that protects us against the downstream failure that's worse.
Right.
Where we all lose our patience and we're like, we never want to talk again. But yeah, I guess observations, hey, I heard, I saw, even I felt, for me is an observation. Whoa, it feels tense. Anybody else? I've done that in meetings before and asked others to do that in meetings before. Because if I'm the one feeling, let's say, tense because I have a large stake in the topic, I'm less likely to notice the context that I'm feeling And I'm probably working a little quicker to prove my point and making assumptions, and that bias is in place. If someone outside of that effect can just go, hey, it feels intense. Anybody else? And that's the key right there. Hey, calm down. It's another accusatory statement. And I've never seen it really help somebody who's feeling a little bit worked up calm down. So it's just like, hey, it feels tense. Anybody else? Ask for more observation and data. And then somebody might ask, oh yeah, what's making it feel intense? And then we can say, oh, it just sounds like your voice is raised or you're talking a little faster. That distances us again. And we can, you know, I can go, yeah, I guess I'm feeling a little bit worked up because I care about this or something. And I've already had a calming effect by that. We can do that for each other. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would say, you know, practice, you know, or something that causes you to slow down. Find that thing, whatever that is, that causes you to slow down. I had one coach tell me, tap on your leg or just, you know, tap your fingers together. Somebody's probably not going to notice it very much, but that will cause me to go back to data, you know, in my head, you know, when I'm feeling worked up, something like that can help too.
Fantastic. I want to kind of get us moving forward because we're going to be running out of time a little bit. So I just wanted to kind of hit a couple of the other topics. So on here you had micro retrospectives. And so I know that Austin and I have talked a little bit about micro retrospectives in the past, but it might be different than your context. So maybe give us your experience and tell us about it.
Sure. Thinking back to Lean and the real definition of continuous improvement that I heard by reading about their kata and that kind of a thing, that continuous improvement to them, as I understand it, means every day, every process, improving that continuously. It's not at the end of a sprint, find something. I mean, that's a Scrum example, which has its place, and I'm not here to criticize that. It's a great opportunity for a retrospective, add a context and a scope for a purpose. But naturally it has some trade-offs, right? We're waiting, we're delaying the feedback and the benefit, and we're actually increasing the chances that we don't remember. And then we have to put in processes to help us remember, which may or may not be distracting, right? Or helpful. You know, okay, I'm gonna go write this down so we can come back to it. And even then it's like, well, I don't even remember the context of why I wrote this down. We've probably all had those experiences. So the idea of continuous improvement to me suggests that processes like retrospectives, which provide feedback, and in the DevOps mentality, the three ways, if we've heard of those, end-to-end delivery, rapid feedback from production all the way to the beginning of development, and then shortening side cycles of that process while we continuously improve, right? So continuous delivery even says we want to fail fast, we want to ship fast, we want to reduce batch sizes. So let's apply that same approach to retrospectives. That's kind of the way I think about it, is just making them small, doing them at least once a day, sometimes every couple of hours, and find out what's working for us that we can do better. You know, just being with you quality folks and Woody Zuhl, and just this, what can we turn up that's good? And this concept that I've heard from him of fading problems. I found a lot of benefit of just applying those same things, just shorten the cycle, get that feedback, focus on the good, and that we usually have a lot of problems that just deal with themselves.
Nice. Yeah, I've seen a couple of situations where there have been, you know, in our mobbing timer, there's a 45 minute cycle. At the end of every 45 minutes, there's a retrospective that essentially is a very kind of fast version, in the sense that there's cards, each with a different symbol on them. You hold up that card, and if everybody's good, then you kind of move on. But if there's something, you know, like one of the pictures is an elephant in the room. I think this came from Willem Larson, actually. And or it's a big elephant. And so it's, the idea is like there's an elephant in the room that no one's talking about. So like that's a reason to kind of stop. Sometimes people can shuffle those things. And so that was the Safari retrospective. But it was very, it's nice because it's very fast and got people. The commitment level was very low. So people are not like, oh, this is going to be a 45 minute retro or 45 minutes for retro and 45 minutes for work all day or something. And so what it turned into was like exposing problems quickly in a very inexpensive way and then working through those early. But then I've seen other styles as well, different cadences and things. So I really love the idea.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a follow-up question. And one thing I wanted to share real quick was, in my recent mobbing, I think I've switched from schedule-based mini retros to event-based. So the previous team I was on, we would do a mini retro multiple times a day. It was like at least once before lunch and then once before the end of the day. Mm. And then when I came into a new mob, I would bring up the idea and they seemed resistant to it. But what I've noticed is that it's just natural micro retros. So it'd just be like something good just really happened. And so we'd be like, okay, we're declaring a mini retro right now. How do we turn up this good thing? Or something bad happened. We say, hey, I want a retro about this item right now. You know what I mean? And it's more event based, but it's almost like pulling the end on cord, right? And being like, hey, let's before we continue in the code, let's talk about this. What styles have you seen practically to help with mini retros in your experience?
Yeah. I think that example that you used is fantastic because you're coupling the retrospective activity to the need for it, right? Mm-hmm. You're just kind of putting those things together, which focuses on kind of like the lean change management concept that I've heard with experimentation is focus on the benefit, measurable evidence and learning over the process. And if mm-hmm. we schedule things, it often starts to just feel like we're doing the process. But yeah, you're bringing the event or I guess the retrospective activity to the event. So I love that. And then we can identify a few indicators that the team might find valuable. Like, hey, we're getting confused or we're slowing down and it feels like we're not getting traction on understanding. Let's pause and ask maybe why. Where sometimes I think we pour our efforts in and how we can just get it if we keep going, but we're doing worse and people can sense it. So that might be an indicator, right? Or like you said, hey, that was a huge win. Let's make sure we understand why in case there's something that we could try again, right? When this happens, let's go ahead and celebrate so that maybe the outcome is knowledge sharing, right? Let's capture that knowledge before we all forget about it and tell the story, hey, we had this great time, and then it gets vague and we don't really know why. Maybe now we can say, here's why, and we can share that with our organization. So less of fixing a problem, but more of producing some shared learning in an artifact we can share. So I love those two examples. The other one that one of my teams who first explored mob programming, we came up with the analogy of a flat tire. So we're driving in the mobbing vehicle and we're doing our thing and then we get a flat tire and it's totally unexpected and it's not the problem we're working on, but it's disrupting our working. So I guess we call an audible and we say, let's go fix the flat tire. And we talk about that, you know, and we'll put all of our focus onto that thing, whether it's the platform we're working on or the subsystem or something we just didn't expect, but we can't move forward successfully without it. At least the team has decided we can't. Maybe it's a mock. Maybe it's a stub, maybe it's a lighter weight way to spin up a server. Sometimes we can get a container running with bad data if we just spend an hour, and it's gonna help us more than maybe that sample server that we had running for a while and now it's a problem, right? Let's just remove all those dependencies, right? So that's kind of like the flat tire concept for us. And we might stop and have a little retro to decide what to do about it. Do we persist? Do we work around? Do we replace? And what time box? We've done that sometimes, and it's been very helpful as well.
I think I'm going to take that and use that analogy today because I think that's a great heuristic, right? Because I think, you know, in a mob or in a conversation, it's like we're talking about topic A, and then someone brings up, hey, Z, and you're like, oh, yeah, look at Z over there. And yeah. I think the question is like, is this a flat tire, Z? And then if it is, yeah, we should go switch to Z. Or if it's not, let's put it on the board and we'll come back to it kind of thing. And that's I'm glad you brought it up. But is it slowing us down for what we're doing now kind of thing? And I think, yeah, I think I'll try that out because it helps determine a distraction versus like, hey, our car is totally wrecked, but we're still trying to drive it, you know? Yeah. So, yeah. That's really helpful. Thank you.
This IDE is a flat tire.
I've been having that conversation with my mom lately as well. So, oh, nice. Well, I think we are coming up somewhat close to our time box. Is there anything you would like to share or plug before we close it out, Mark?
No, I think just if I can shoot you guys some references of things we talked about for the show notes, I think that will really help anybody who's interested in more. There'll be more examples that you can glean from those resources.
Yeah. Fantastic. So I know we didn't cover experimentation, but you know, we have time for a little soundbite on experimentation. Is there anything that you wanted to bring forward before we closed out?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I'll just mention in passing, I just worked on drafting the abstract for submission to Agile 2021 to talk about it. So maybe that's a plug if anyone's out there going to attend and, I get the chance to share, then I'll go a little deeper into this topic. But experimentation, I think, is what I'm calling the unit of discovery in product development work, where we're used to the unit of delivery, which is like the feature or the story, where we need to specify this is how it needs to work for this persona for these benefits, and we put some acceptance criteria so everyone knows when it's done, all the stakeholders can call it done, and we need to put it in production so that they can benefit from it, and we need to know upfront that we're delivering the right value. But what about product teams who are trying to respond to the increase in uncertainty and discovery of viable options over the right feature that we want to prioritize? How do we approach that? So maybe the unit of discovery in our backlogs becomes the experiment and specifically the hypothesis. So I've been looking into lean change management. There's a great website on all of this, these thinking and techniques, but the experiment tracking canvas. And it's creating an experiment and with a little framework for it and running it through a very consistent workflow, Kanban, so that the workflow serves the experiment outcome. So we want to prepare it, introduce it, review it, gather insights, and then determine it's done with it succeeded, it had benefits, or it failed. And then we can take that learning back to the next experiment. Any organization, any team can do this. And I think it really is fit for what I want to call dedicated learning. Any team who isn't dedicated time just to learning rather than to delivery, I think will miss the opportunity to achieve real innovation and make significant change, because these are less known, they're more uncertain, and we want to approach them differently than we're used to with the rest of our types of work.
Right on, yeah. Do we know anything about dedicated learning time, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting thing. I really like the note and experimentation, I think, is important, and discovery is important, and dedicating time for experimentation and discovery on teams is really important. If you don't do that, then I think you end up, there's an episode that we had on the virtuous loop, essentially learning sessions and retrospectives causing a cycle of improvement. I think you break without experimentation, you break the virtuous loop and you end up falling into some sort of a situation where things slowly fall apart. And it's kind of the one of the worst situations you can be in, because you're kind of locked into mediocrity at that point. Yeah. Okay, so thank you, Mark, for joining us. This has been really fun.
To our audience,
please like and subscribe. And there's like a little bell next to the subscribe to get notifications every time we release an episode, if you want that too. Or on any of the other podcast platforms, however you get notifications for that. But most importantly, I think if, TDD for people, experimentation or micro retrospectives would be an important thing for somebody that you know to hear about, we think you should definitely share this episode with them, help them out in that way. Sharing these ideas to the people that need them the most is kind of what we're here to do. So thank you very much. And until next time, we'll see you all later. Bye, everybody.